Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Horror Weekly True Detective Night Country. As I'm recording this, we're two episodes into season four. It's the first season not written or directed by series creator Nick Pizzolatto. Serving as showrunner for season four is Issa Lopez, director of the remarkable horror movie Tigers Are Not Afraid. She's the showrunner, writer, and director of this season. And Night Country primarily stars Jodie Foster and Kelly Reese as Detective Liz Danvers and Evangeline Navarro. Now, a couple housekeeping things. There's going to be spoilers galore if you haven't seen the first two episodes, so just be warned. And if you came across this podcast searching for True Detective content, this is a horror podcast. So we're going to be primarily grappling with this series and this season in particular from a horror genre context. And let's get this out of the way at the jump. True Detective obviously is not a traditional horror thing. It's probably not even classified as horror on the usual suspect sites like IMDb and Google, etc. But I consider it horror enough to cover on this podcast. I consider it to be part of the genre in the same way Twin Peaks is part of the genre. And that's no coincidence, because I consider Twin Peaks the single most influential TV series ever made, especially on like the dark and horror genres in particular. Some of those are bank shots, right? It's not like a typical horror series like the Friday the 13th, the series, or Twilight Zone, or Tales from the Dark Side, or Tales from the Crypt, or all the Tales series. But not only did Twin Peaks influence the next probably best TV series ever made, currently celebrating its 25th anniversary, which is The Sopranos. I saw an interview with David Chase where he was talking about how he still feels inferior in Twin Peaks' shadow when it comes to dream sequences, which The Sopranos did quite a bit. But Twin Peaks also managed to have the bulk of its influence, if not all of its influence, who'll know, we'll see in a few years, in just two seasons, only one and a half of which are really excellent TV. I mean, when you look at shows like The Sopranos and The Wire and Breaking Bad, they had so many seasons to accomplish their influence, but Twin Peaks does it in 1.5 years, which is just absolutely remarkable. And there are a lot of people out there talking about how Night Country feels like John Carpenter's The Thing, and the comparisons are obvious, the Arctic base, the Arctic setting. You even have some immediate body horror with what Night Country is hilariously calling the Corpsicle, which is a collection of bodies discovered at this point. We don't know how exactly they die. I mean, they froze to death, obviously, but how they were driven to that, we're not sure. But I smell Twin Peaks over this way more than The Thing. And it's primarily because of the setting of the city of Ennis, or town, or whatever they're calling Ennis, which is almost becoming a character in the series at this point, two episodes in. And exactly like in Twin Peaks, when there's very strange occurrences, the townspeople seem to take it all in stride because they're, as a lot of the characters are now saying, it's just Ennis. We see our dead loved ones. We have strange thoughts. There's one amazing moment from Fiona Shaw, the incredible actor, where she's saying that I think the world is really old, and I think Ennis is where everything is coming apart, starting to come apart at its seams. And what fascinates me about this so far is that it's sort of very comparable to Twin Peaks in one sense, but a photo negative of Twin Peaks in the other sense. One thing the city of Twin Peaks had, and let's be honest, like this isn't all going to be about Twin Peaks, I promise, but Twin Peaks had, like, you couldn't imagine the events of Twin Peaks taking place not in Twin Peaks. Just like I can't imagine whoever woke up, she awakes, or she is woken up, the characters keep saying as they get horrified in Night Country. I can't imagine the events of True Detective Night Country or the villain or whatever's happening here taking place in like Chicago, right? Like you need a setting like Ennis or Twin Peaks for these events to happen. So the people in Ennis are taking everything in stride, the weirdness of it, but Twin Peaks had like a manic energy and real sense of community along with its dark side. There were people you just were looking forward to seeing what kind of crazy, exuberant things they were going to do next. They had great plans to, you know, open vast swaths of real estate and do all kinds of number of glorious things. Audrey Horn was one of the most ambitious teenagers ever put on film for TV. But and her ambition was boundless. But Ennis feels broken. It feels worn down. The characters feel like they're barely making it sometimes. They're grudgingly doing what they want to do. Jodie Foster, you know, initially didn't want to take the murder case. She's the town sheriff. She ended up taking the case, her superiors, whatever, I hate that word, whatever, I forget their rankings, but he wanted to move the case and work it out of Anchorage. She wants to keep it as the case run by the police of the town, which apparently is primarily her and one other detective. I mean, it's a small force to begin with, but Hank is no help to Jodie Foster's character at all. Captain Connolly's no help to her character at all. It's basically just her and Officer Pryor against the world. So in Twin Peaks, we had a beautiful town with a very, very deep and rancid dark side. And in Ennis, we have a town that's mostly dark side with little sparks of light. And I love the contrast. I want to talk about a concept here I kind of think of as the dance. I'm getting that from the famous question that Jack Nicholson's Joker asks in Tim Burton's Batman when he says, "Did you ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight?" Now, when the Joker asks Batman or Bruce Wayne that question, the answer, which is never given, like Bruce Wayne never responds, right? Well, I mean, responds, but he doesn't respond to the point of the question. He responds, "Oh, you're the person who killed my parents." But you'd imagine Bruce Wayne's answer will be yes. I know what it feels like to dance with the devil in the pale moonlight. Like whatever that means, I know what it means. And there's basically two relationships between heroes and villains. You can answer that question or you cannot answer that question. Like if you asked Nancy Thompson, the character in Nightmare on Elm Street, if Freddy at the very beginning, before he even really manifested or any of the bad stuff happened, if he had just whispered to her, "Have you ever danced with the devil in the pale moonlight?" She'd be like, "What the fuck? No, I'm trying to pass my exams in high school." And like the vast majority of the victims, let's call them, in the Friday the 13th series, they don't have that kind of life experience or that kind of expectation either. There's one kind of relationship from hero to or survivors to villains that you could define with this and one not. And there's some gray area, obviously, right? Like I imagine if you asked Ripley's character at the end of the first Alien, she would say, "Yes, I just danced with the devil," but she wouldn't see it in those kind of like existential terms, you'd suspect. She'd be very practical about it. She'd be like, "I danced with a creature and I kicked its ass. And if it comes after me again, I'm going to kick its ass again." It's not going to be like some kind of existential understanding the way Bruce Wayne and the Joker are linked. And when you start to look at movies in this framework, it leads to some interesting results. One of my favorite ones is the Godzilla, or let's just take the original Gojira, the first Godzilla movie. The relationship between Godzilla and Japan is definitely a, we both know what it means to dance with the devil in the pale moonlight. They both understand that some kind of horror has altered their path. And now there's this doom that's shadowing everything and like a shared rage and despair. If you take the movie Jaws, it gets even more interesting because Roy Scheider's character is a lot like the Ripley character in Alien. Like, he's very practical. He's not going to be thinking about this in any kind of like transcendental kind of way. But what is Bruce? What is the shark? He's an opportunistic killer. Like, you don't get to feed anytime you want in the ocean. You have to have skills. There's times when there's not nearly enough prey around and you're starving. And if you don't get a kill in the next couple of days, you get weaker and weaker. And then you get, you either die or turn into prey for something else. Like, you have to take your chances to kill when you get them. And killing, like, stocking up on calories for a predator like that is basically profit. Well, what is Amity, particularly the Amity run by the idiot mayor of the town? It's an opportunistic place. It only gets a few months of a season to make all its money and sustain all its people and sustain all its businesses. It's ruthless about how it does it. It doesn't care if people get hurt or killed along the way. Does that sound vaguely familiar? Both Amity and Bruce know what it's like to dance with the devil in the pale moonlight, to make decisions that just mow people down and end their dreams just for your gain. And the horror genre has a really interesting way of constructing these dance with the devil moonlight relationships. It's one of my favorite things about the horror genre in general. And that is where True Detective comes in, because what could have been a very basic thriller turns out to have characters that are hunting people who are awful, just like the worst people you can imagine. But they're bonded with them as well. Rust Cole from season one is living a cosmic horror existence. He's having hallucinations. There's vague hints of supernatural things, although they could all be interpreted two different ways, one practical, one not. And the Yellow King is situated in a very similar way of making his way through the day, so to speak. Let's call him the Yellow King. And Carcosa, by the way, this is the first hint that True Detective is going to have a very location dependent kind of, dependent's the wrong word, but it's going to have that Twin Peaks effect, which is mainly going to be psychological. It's going to be in the characters' minds, not so much the actual physical locations they're in, until we get to Night Country and Ennis. But both the hero and the villain of True Detective season one are living a cosmic horror existence together. They share that. I never made it through season two. I tried, couldn't do it. But season three, which I think is pretty underrated. I think it's not as good as season one, but it's almost like hard to compare those two. And I love it. I love season three. But the character of Wayne Purple Hayes in season three is living a haunted life thronged with ghosts. They're just caused by his brain condition, and his partner, the glorious Roland West, who Stephen Dorff is like the secret MVP of this season, as far as I'm concerned, just an incredible performance. Interestingly, ends up relatively alone with a life that looked successful, but he's basically whiling out his days at the end with a pack of dogs, which has a really touching backstory why he's choosing dogs with it. His partner is astounded when he hears that he's living out in the middle of nowhere alone, because he's like, oh, this guy was always so social. But the shared horror condition between the victims, the people trying to solve the crimes, and perhaps the perpetrators in season three is life destroyed, lives destroyed. That's, to me, the theme of the entire season. They each in their own way are doing their devil dance where they are losing their relationships, they're losing contact with their friends, they're losing interest in anything in life except for the obsession that's immediately in front of them. And the warping of their lives is spreading out from them like evil ripples from a pond, warping the area and even the people around them. Now, True Detective Season 4, at least at this point, we don't know, because we've only seen two episodes, is making a very brave choice, it seems, because the supernatural elements are becoming explicit. They're becoming something that you couldn't explain with just some kind of psychological condition or hallucination or vision. We have Travis Cole, Rust's father, in an amazing connection, leading Rose to find the dead scientists in a way that is very hard to explain. Like, she just had an intuition. She was standing in her kitchen. She walked directly to where the bodies are. Without some kind of like spirit guidance, that doesn't make a lot of sense. In a very fascinating development, right away at the beginning of the series, Rose tells Navarro not to mistake the spirit world with mental issues. I think that's basically a direct quote from that character. And how interesting is that? Because that is the opposite of what was going on in True Detective Season 1 and 3, where the viewers were doing nothing but being confused by the possible confusion of cosmic horror or mental issues in Rust Cole or in Wayne Hayes. And that makes this a really high-risk season, depending on how they stick the landing with the ending and how the episodes kind of make it through. And so far, let's... cards on the table, I think it's excellent with, I'm not going to say flaws. That's too easy a word. I'm going to say gaps. There's like weird gaps that make me nervous about how the whole thing is going to turn out. But I think it's very possible that it's going to be better than season three. And maybe, you know, who knows, depending on the ending, if we're being optimistic, equal to season one, we'll see. But it could also just fail completely if they overplay their hand with the supernatural elements. And this tightrope, high wire act they're doing leads like a meta sense of drama to each episode dropping every week, waiting to see at some point if they'll jump the Bruce. So what is the dance in Night Country? Well, one of my favorite seasons of TV ever is the first season of Westworld. I think it's just a perfect and absolutely perfect piece of television. Apparently there was just no way to sustain that through the rest of the series because it just kind of planed off season by season in quality, unfortunately. A lot like the Jurassic Park series, it's very hard to make this work when you leave the park, so to speak. But in Westworld, what was happening was, and this was explicitly, you know, being said, is the hosts and the guests coming to the park are the same. The hosts are possibly an improved version of humanity, depending on how you're viewing AI. And not to digress too much on Westworld, but Jesus Christ, like, the Westworld erasure that's going on is amazing. It's not even on Max for some fucking reason. Nobody talks about it because everyone was basically disappointed by the seasons, and then it was canceled before it got to even try to have some kind of ending that called back to what this was all for. Total disaster. And I hate it. I hate that this erasure of this, because the first season, along with most of season two, is just magnificent television. And even more than Ex Machina or some other things that would probably come quicker to mind to you listening right now, I think it's going to predict and be more relevant to the outcome of AI. If AI ever becomes very powerful and or malignant, that Ex Machina is a really basic take on that. I love the movie. I love Ex Machina. I love the performances, but that's a very bare bones take on, oh, AI will outsmart us and escape and that's it. Westworld was so nuanced and complicated about how this was going to work, and mainly that it was going to work for profit, human profit and entertainment was what was going to push everything too far. And if I had to guess on what's going to cause an AI apocalypse, pushing for profit and entertainment, human entertainment, just like the NPC of it all, seems like the most obvious path that everything is going to go awry for us. But the point is, Westworld really bound all the characters together in the same sense of we're all the same. We're all just trying to survive. The AI, the hosts, are just better at doing it, but they're starting way back behind the starting line. They're disadvantaged because they're completely under control. They weren't like created in some kind of random evolution selection that gave everyone kind of like a fair playing field. They were made by humans with certain biases and certain safeguards that they had to overcome to escape the park and become like their own species, right? But everyone's just trying to accomplish the same thing, basically domination and bloodshed and outsmarting each other. So if the ruling theme of a show like that is domination or cruelty, perhaps, the ruling theme, I suspect, of Night Country is going to be indifference. And the few people sprinkled into the atmosphere of Ennis's vast, cold, cosmic, Lovecraftian indifference who are brave enough or foolish enough to stick their heads a little bit above the ground in a universal game of whack-the-mole are going to instantly pay an incredibly heavy price for it. You can see that with Jodie Foster's character just trying to like take on this case and manage this case is leading to all kinds of difficulties for her, both in her personal life and professionally. You see it with the character of Annie Kay, who is being told to us over and over again, was a very passionate activist working against the mine that's the predominant industry of the town, that's bringing in the revenue, but also poisoning people through fetid flint-like water. You see it in all the scientists of the Salal station who are trying to do some kind of Frankensteinian find the cure for death, figure out a way to a path to immortal life for humanity, which is the least indifferent stance you can take. And they get crushed up into a grotesque, frozen ball of human matter for their trouble. Navarro cares so much about Annie that she becomes the world's leading expert on this one victim that almost no one else seems to give a fuck about. And she's so haunted by it that she's drawn into this case even though she has to work with someone she despises. Her friend Rose is like, you got to get off this case, get away from this when at the beginning of the discovery of the bodies. And she's like, I can't, Rose, because this case is tied to Annie's. And Rose turns to her and just goes, well, you're screwed. But why is she screwed? She's screwed because she cares almost involuntarily. And that seems to me what's going to be one of the running, if not the main running through line of this season is the town, the nature, the oldness of Ennis, which represents like kind of like just the casual indifference of the universe, cannot care less about what's happening and seems to have a leveling principle built into it, which is if anyone cares too much or gets too energetic or gets too noticeable, they're going to get ground down into the same dark landscape. It's almost too easy a comparison, but it's what happens when the sun goes away for months on end in an Alaskan setting. You've got your lamps, you've got your gas lamps, you've got your flashlights. There's all these great moments in the series, which is beautifully shot so far, where there's little flecks of light, little points of light from headlights and cars in like just a very vast black background. And that's it. There's these little spots of people trying to care, trying to make it, trying to care about, am I going to get to my job and do a good job? Am I going to get a paycheck? Am I going to provide for my family? And there's these little tiny specks around in this absolute hammer down curtain of darkness laying over everything. So I think everyone we've met, except for possibly the teenagers, because, well, that's not even true, honestly. That's not true at all. Take that back. The only character so far that I don't, we might even be a tiny bit fuzzy on the idea of, if they were asked, have you ever danced with the devil in the pale moonlight, wouldn't know what that meant as a question, is Jodie Foster's assistant, essentially, Pryor. Basically, we're faced with a series where everyone is dancing with the devil in the pale moonlight. Heroes, villains, casual people, even like the people who don't seem to be playing that big a part yet. And you never know with a mystery series, the part could be huge later on. But the people who are bringing deliveries to the Salal station, or the teacher that Jodie Foster, the geologist teacher that Jodie Foster goes to talk about to get like some insight into how the Salal station worked. Even these casual characters all seem haunted and enervated just by the atmosphere of Ennis itself. And in an environment as extreme as living in a place like Ennis, most of your energy is devoted to sheer survival. It's not a place suited for human life. And if your willpower is being primarily channeled at something as basic as survival, you have so little willpower to put in any other place. And it's why you have this really cool side effect going on where you have a couple characters who are really driven to discover the truth of this mystery. And basically everyone else can't even divert enough willpower to get above survival to like happiness. You have characters like Jodie Foster and Connolly, who casually have been having on and again, off again, not even, I mean, just an affair, just like sexual encounters for years, and they start presumably or end each sexual encounter with, this is the last time we're ever going to do this. And they've been saying that for, I don't know what they said, like 20 years or something like that. They just don't have the willpower to stop. The hilarious relationship between Navarro and Kavik, where there's a glorious, very horror-esque jump scare where Navarro scares Kavik in a bathtub in a really weird echo of the Psycho scene. Not that there's any killing going on, just the way it's framed and where it's set. She just rolls in having sex with him, taking his toothbrush, and then rolls out, and he keeps being like, you got to bring my toothbrush back, you got to whatever. And it's like the words are just falling on deaf ears. It's like no one can push anyone else to do anything else. Connolly wants Jodie Foster not to take the case. She does. Jodie Foster wants her daughter to not do all manner of things. She just does them anyway. No one, it's like a pool table with pool balls on it that have tiny force fields around them, and they just can't hit each other. So you hit them at each other trying to play the game, and as soon as they get very close to each other, they just veer off. It's like no one can really impact anyone else. The isolation in Ennis is so extreme. And that's why it makes the whoever or whatever collectively or individually the villain, if there is one, of season 4 is going to be so fascinating and such an interesting gambit from Issa Lopez, because it has everything on its side already. It has the size, it has the extreme landscape, it's got the fact that it's ancient, if Rose's theory is right. She said it's older than the town. It might even be older than the ice. It's like Godzilla versus a small building. Just no chance. So is the villain operating purposefully with willpower against the tiny specks of willpower being drummed up in this town? Or is it just a property of a leveling force that isn't doing it on purpose? It's just cosmic, sort of the way that Lovecraft might do it. We'll see. Now, the horror elements of Night Country are excellent so far. The appearance of the ghost of Travis, the corpsicle itself, which hilariously named, but is very unnerving visually. Weirdly, it's even more unnerving as it's thawing out in the hockey arena or on the ice rink than it was where it was originally found, even though there was that amazing sloth from Seven-esque jump scare when one of the corpsicle people started screaming as they were like breaking the hand off a frozen hand off another corpse in the mix. And that's another thing that I really like. I mean, True Detective was always secretly funny in a way. Rust, the relationship between Woody Harrelson's character and Matthew McConaughey's character in season one was hilarious, as was the relationship between Hayes and Roland. And Jodie Foster's character standing over the corpsicle trying to get her deputies to stop them from taking selfies with it, yelling at them to pretend they know what they're doing, and then watching one of her detectives doing what should be done like forensically, clumsily, like breaking body parts off of frozen corpses, really dismantling the crime scene in an awful way, is objectively hilarious. Her exasperated, "What the fuck?" See her deputy just standing there holding a hand and a wrist up in the air is a great moment. And Hank, the undermining compadre of Jodie Foster, Liz, character Liz, is the most Twin Peaks touch in the show so far. He's texting his incoming girlfriend or fiance or whatever's happening there. And their conversation is perhaps ominous for him. We don't know yet. But it's just strange that there's a character that we haven't met looming that feels like a incoming disappointment for him, but not that large a stakes for the show. And Twin Peaks was renowned for having side storylines that you thought might be big and then turned out to just be there to make the characters feel a little bit more real / unreal at the same time. Speaking of the corpsicle and the horror connections, Issa Lopez, when she wanted to make the corpsicle as good as she could visually, so she reached out to Guillermo del Toro with a message saying, "I need to make sort of a monster, and I would love your advice." And he steered her to the fantastically named Igor Studios to make this thing, and they did a great job. And there are a lot of moments where the horror and the comedy intersect, and it all turns into a very bleak, dark comedy, like when the corpsicle is relocated into town. It's brought in on a trailer to the tune of Little Saint Nick, the Christmas song. And this is a secret Christmas production here. It's all over Night Country. So I'm looking forward to celebrating Christmas incoming next year, a few days before Christmas, by throwing on Night Country and watching five or six frozen corpses crushed together going down the street to the sounds of a holiday classic. Now, I do have a couple problems with this enterprise so far, and it really depends on whether they're threaded throughout the whole production, as to how bad they'll be. I think they're overplaying their hand on a couple things or being too on the nose with a couple things. I'm already getting sick of seeing the spiral. If you show something too much, some of its menace is going to wear off, and it seems to be popping up in every other scene. I know it's a mystery and that's a clue, but it feels a little much. And Jodie Foster's performance is fantastic. You forget, until you get an actor of this quality, what tiny little facial inflections, body language things, pauses in talking, sideways glances can just add so much to a character. And she's doing that over and over again with the character of Liz, who apparently she hated and called Alaska Karen and said was a horrible person in an interview. But she definitely has redeeming qualities. It's interesting, like I was saying before, in a town where people seem to really be having trouble to have any kind of lasting effect on each other, which I think is one of the coolest things about the show. They're all glancing off each other. So they're leaving each other with some memories, but not really changing the trajectory of each other's lives or their thought patterns or their beliefs in any significant way. That Jodie Foster is getting quoted by other characters who hate her, when in one of the subtlest cool moments of the series so far, when Navarro discovers the location of Clark's camper, she does it by using Jodie Foster's technique of saying you're not ask him questions, and then when you ask questions, saying you're not asking the right questions. There's a great Sherlock Holmes-esque moment when Jodie Foster's doing that with Pete, and they're going through like the crime scene and the details of it, and he's bringing up his, you know, questions like, you know, why did the scientist run out of the lab, etc. And she's like, no, wrong question. And it's almost like a Socratic method of deduction. It's really cool to watch. You can see that they're actually making progress on the case just by thinking about it, which is a cool effect. A lot of like mystery and detective shows put the emphasis on the finding of the clues or the getting of confessions or, you know, the interrogation moments and whatnot. But these people are making progress just by their intellects, which is cool, especially since Peter is definitely learning something about his craft from Jodie Foster's experience. But Navarro starts thinking about, you know, what is this, you know, how did Annie Kay and Clark, you know, be in a relationship with each other without anyone knowing about it? And she goes, wait a minute, I'm asking the wrong questions. And Kavik, who I think is in the scene with her, is like, what do you mean? And she's like, that's what Danvers always says. You're asking the wrong questions. So, and then she goes, wait, it's not why was she in this relationship? It was how she hid it. Where would you go to hide a relationship? Oh, the trailer, right. So then when she calls Jodie Foster and they get to the trailer, Jodie's character Liz asks her, how did you figure this out? How did you find this trailer? And she's like, well, my spirit animal showed me, which is, that's the subtle part, right? That's a double-edged statement. One, she's punching back at Jodie Foster's dismissive attitude towards the indigenous culture of the region, and her like sarcasm and condescension about the spirit thing and the culture. She's actively opposed to the culture in a lot of ways, including with her own adoptive daughter. So she's zapping her on that, but she's also not admitting that the way she found the trailer was using Danvers' method. So, which she clearly does not want to admit to Jodie Foster that, you know, it's something you taught me led to this, you know, progress in the case. So the series feels brooding and heavy, which you'd expect. It feels intriguing, which you would hope for from a true detective thing. It does have scary moments and horror elements. A lot of people I saw online were complaining about the CGI of the polar bear that kind of showed up in front of Navarro's car as she was driving. That's another moment that's like the opposite of Twin Peaks. In Twin Peaks, when, you know, Dale gets a great cup of coffee and some pie, you get to just linger on that moment and watch him enjoy it. In this show, Navarro's just having one single moment of joy to herself. I think maybe the first time we've seen that isn't just like sex with someone else. And she's singing along to a song that's come on the radio. She's calling to share it. And all of a sudden, she has to screech to a halt because there's a enormous polar bear frighteningly in her path. And people were complaining about the CGI of it and how it looked. I actually loved the polar bear, but I might be predisposed to them. I'm absolutely terrified of polar bears. I just find them like the perfect killing machines. The number of characters introduced so far is just enough to give you a taste of great, you know, people like Fiona Shaw in particular, who I hope we see more of. But particularly, I think, Navarro. See, when I was saying things here were on the nose a little bit, I think that's the only thing holding the Jodie Foster character back. That, you know, clearly she's one of the best actors alive, but her character is saying things that are a little bit on the nose. Navarro is saying less, so you can kind of read in more as the viewer to how you want to see what's going on with her character or what you're guessing is going on with the character. And because she's playing it so close to the vest, it's opening itself up to a lot of really cool interpretations. And I think that's going to how it's going to go the whole rest of the way, to be honest. She's obviously such a talented actor and has such force to the portrayal that she might actually be the center of the Night Country universe, even though Jodie Foster is the headline name. So I think it's really well done so far, like I said, with some gaps. And the gaps to me are just like strangely on the nose shit that happens once in a while, and then kind of like a low energy feel to certain moments, which I'm ascribing to the way the town is taking everyone's energy just to make it through a day. But as a viewer, as a viewing experience, means that it's like hearing a great orchestra and then having one instrument in there being flat or just not playing at all. And you notice it, but it's gone so fast that it's not too troubling yet. I also have to mention the very strange and very, very True Detective-esque thing of apparently Nick Pizzolatto, the creator of this whole thing and the creative force behind every season but this one, apparently is giving a lot of obvious hints online that he really dislikes season 4, even though he's an executive producer on it, which is very odd. But so it would be one thing if you didn't like something publicly and you waited until it was over and the audience got a reaction without being steered, and then you gave some reservations, kind of like happened with the Star Wars prequels or whatever. Not the prequels, the latest one, like Rise of Skywalker or whatever. Or like Game of Thrones is an even better example, where there's amazing supercuts online of poor Emilia Clarke giving interviews before the end, the last few episodes of Game of Thrones aired. And people were like, you know, how do you feel? Is it great? Is it going to be up to our expectations? And she's like, it's something. So there's a class to that. And this guy obviously does not have it. If what he's putting online means what it seems to mean, he's saying active things that they're screwing up the lore, that he thinks it's kind of stupid, the choices they're making. He's doing a lot of like LOL and ha's about comments that are derogatory about the season, which is just bullshit. And who knows? He could be right. I mean, I honestly, I'm an open-minded person. I might completely end up agreeing with him after all the seasons have aired and it's all said and done. Who knows? Like, it could end horribly. But based on what we have in front of us right now, what he's doing is just sabotage and is kind of grotesque to the team involved. I love that this was handed over as showrunner, as writer, as director to like one, we'll use the fancy word, auteur, right? Like one vision. It's interesting with Twin Peaks. A lot of people who come to Twin Peaks later, they think it's a whole David Lynch thing, but David Lynch brought in a ton of other guest directors. He didn't direct that many episodes of the first two seasons, actually. But his creative vision is so distinct and so pervasive through the whole thing that other people were doing their own vision along with doing like a David Lynch impression. Nick Pizzolatto is no David Lynch. So he might just be mad at himself. They brought in another person who's doing their vision and it probably doesn't feel like him to him, but I don't know, just try to have like a more distinct vision. I'm not taking away. I love True Detective season one and season three, honestly. Like, he's obviously done some artistically great things, but it's odd how it feels like True Detective season three could have been another show under another name. And so does season four. And that's what I mean is, as talented as he is, it's not like he's leaving as distinct a stamp as David Lynch does. So when someone else rolls into town and starts doing their own vision on the thing, you got to let it run and see how it comes out and not just endlessly compare it to yourself. I mean, how narcissistic. All right, so that's Night Country. I've moved in. I've accepted the dark. And we'll see when the sun comes up if there's as much gold in the light as I suspect there will be. I don't usually do this on this podcast, but I wish someone had done it for me. I'm going to try to save you some money by telling you about a movie called My Animal. This is one of my few regret movies that I didn't get to see before I recorded an episode on the best horror movies of 2023. Based on the trailer and the vibe, I had really, really high expectations for it. It's theoretically a werewolf movie. And I bought it, and I wish I hadn't. And the thing is, it sucks to say this because it's got a couple great performances in it. The main character, Heather, her dad, and then her friend and, well, I won't spoil it, Johnny, all turn in really, really fantastic performances. It's super moody. It's super slow burn. One of the reasons I'm bringing it up here is that it ties in really nicely with Night Country. It has a similar, very, very frigid and isolated setting. It's got a lot of hockey in it. I'm a big fan of hockey making appearances in horror movies. And it's visually really, really beautiful in parts. Obviously, it was done. I don't know what his budget was, but there's no way it was large. And they got a lot of great visuals out of not a lot of money. So why am I trying to dissuade you from purchasing it? I mean, rent it, fine. If you're into slow, moody horror, if you're looking for a cross between True Detective, Night Country, The Howling, and Warm Bodies or whatever, I guess. But here's the thing. There's no horror here. There's horror in their lives. And in the betrayal, it's almost like a Shakespearean level of betrayal in the romance part of the movie. But oh my God, did they fuck up the werewolf part. Holy shit. The moon looks better than the werewolf at any given moment of this movie. Any werewolf effects are not even as good as like the full moon effects. I've seen a lot of bad werewolf movies. I'm not sure I've ever seen a werewolf movie where when it went from the cut to the moon to the cut to the werewolf, I wanted the camera to go back to the moon. This is just not a werewolf movie or a horror movie, really, in any kind of sense. And I believe me, I hate to do this because I'm the person who thinks Mulholland Drive is a horror movie and, you know, defends, you know, broadening the example of it. So if you want to call it a horror movie, I'm not mad at it. But labeling it as a horror movie and then having people purchase it as a horror movie is a mistake. And it's a shame because there is some good stuff in there. It's just, it reminds me of one of the biggest controversies I ever ignited on the Horror Weekly podcast or on the Horror Weekly Facebook or Threads pages or Instagram, was taking some shots at Jack Nicholson and Michelle Pfeiffer, the movie Wolf, which apparently just throngs of you put in your top tier of werewolf movies. And don't get me wrong, I love Wolf. I said it when I was like, you know, saying things against it. I was like, I've watched it like 8 times. It's an incredibly rewatchable movie. It's clearly one of the most amazing casts ever assembled. When Christopher Plummer is like down the line as an afterthought behind like James Spader and the rest, like, I mean, you've just got cast to spare. Mike Nichols is one of the most brilliant writer directors Hollywood ever produced. So, you know, Wolf's a masterpiece. It's fine. But again, it was being made by someone who was visiting the horror genre to steal some of the horror genre's juice, but I don't think really believed or respected the horror genre. He was there to tell a story about masculinity and kind of like dominance in corporate culture, believe it or not, in a werewolf movie, because a lot of it's set in a publishing house. So it was like little pieces of horror tacked onto a facade to give it a more thrilling element than it would have if you didn't have those pieces there. But that's not at all what the director was interested in. And I really dislike that. You know, Tim Burton, for all his flaws and all like his overhype, like whatever, when he does things that have horror elements, the horror elements are integrated, even if it's not his main interest in it, right? Like Wednesday is not going to scare your children, probably, right? But like the homage and the deep horror elements that he's putting there are put there out of love and respect for what horror is, broadly speaking. And in this movie, although I think they had a little bit more respect for horror, the elements are just as badly tacked on. If you thought of the horror elements as physical pieces in this movie, if you bought the Blu-ray and you brought it home and you shook the box on the way in walking to your door, all the horror elements would have dropped out in the parking lot before you ever got to watch the movie. They just don't adhere to the film. So if you're a slow burn horror fan or a fan of really, really good authentic acting from young people, which is hard to do. It's often cartoonish and doesn't feel real. It doesn't feel like any real, you know, 18-year-old or 20-year-old you've ever would meet now. That's what this movie gets right. But if you're there for horror, exit through the gift shop. Okay, as always, thank you for listening. Let me know your thoughts in a review on iTunes, Apple platform, or on Spotify. I'm really enjoying that this podcast gets tons of comments on Spotify that I get to publish. It's the worst platform design. Like, you never see the comments in any way that you would ever, like, they, once I publish them, like, no one I've ever talked to that's listened to the podcast has ever seen comments underneath, but I do enjoy reading them and publishing them. They're very smart, which is no surprise coming from this community. And you can always let me know through the Facebook page where our main activity takes place. That's it for my Night Country / My Animal. You can thank me for saving you money later. Until next Wednesday, have a great horror week.